to Broadcaster at Large, challenging the assumptions we live by. I'm your host and producer, Kelly L. Romaris. Today's expanded version of Broadcaster at Large is single-payer healthcare. Today's featured speaker is Dr. Margaret Flowers, MD, a Baltimore pediatrician who is now working for Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP. But you will also hear from others as this program draws on previous work I have done on the healthcare issue. Dr. Flowers began our talk by describing what drove her and other doctors like her out of practice.
When I finished my training, I thought that I was ready to go out and take care of patients, and that's what I would be doing, and found out that the insurance company was really there every step of the way, telling me which medications my patients could have, which tests they could and couldn't have, how many days they could stay in the hospital. And their determinations were not always what was best for the patient, and they weren't based on what was best for the patient. In private practice, not only did we have to deal with insurance administrators, we had to fight for approval for medications and tests, but we also had to fight just simply to get paid for the care that we delivered. They would play all kinds of games, making us fax in more papers over and over again. And a lot of practices, they end up giving up in some of those situations and not collecting payment for the care that they gave. So particularly for primary care doctors, which is what I am, a pediatrician, we deliver quality care when we spend time with our patients, listening to them and doing a full examination. But you don't get reimbursed for spending time with patients. You get reimbursed for doing procedures. So many of our primary care doctors are struggling or are finding other ways to supplement their practice or are leaving altogether, which is what I did. And many of my colleagues are doing the same thing, leaving practice.
So is the continuation of this private health insurance system going to lead to a shortage of primary care physicians like you?
Yes, and it already has led to a shortage, and it will continue to, because we've seen the numbers of students coming out of medical school and the number of them going into primary care specialties, including emergency medicine and general surgery, are declining. And really the backbone of a strong health system that creates a healthy population is to have a good number of primary care physicians. And if you look at our numbers compared to the other industrialized nations, we're not doing very well.
Is there a disparate impact on women of the private insurance industry?
Well, we do know that, and it's only getting worse, unfortunately. We know that women pay more for their policies because many of them need maternity benefits. Women, on average, have higher preventive health care costs than men do. And what we saw particularly while I was in practice were insurance companies limiting the number of days that mothers could stay in the hospital, you know, after they'd had a baby. So they were required to leave after a certain period of time. And sometimes if things weren't going well initially and the baby had to stay in, you know, the mother couldn't stay in with the baby. Now what we're finding is that pregnancy is being considered a pre-existing condition, and pregnancy is either not being covered or mothers are being denied insurance policies if they've had a cesarean section unless they agree to be sterilized.
That's outrageous.
Yeah.
I just don't even understand the concept of pregnancy as a pre-existing condition.
Right.
Isn't a pre-existing condition some sort of prior disease?
Right.
So they're saying pregnancy is a disease?
Exactly. And, it just gets even more ludicrous than that. In some states, insurance companies can deny coverage for a condition if during the last 5 years you've had a symptom of that condition, whether it's been diagnosed or treated or not. Just having a symptom that could be associated with a condition that you develop is enough to exclude coverage for that condition.
We've also heard that Harvard study that indicates that some 44,000 American adults die annually because they don't have health insurance. Is the impact of uninsurance mainly the fact that the uninsured delay care until it's really late, or are uninsured people actually treated differently by doctors and hospitals?
That's an excellent question. I mean, certainly we know that people without insurance delay getting care, and so by the time that they are sick enough that they do present for care, they often are more expensive to care for or have a worse outcome or die because they've waited too long. People are denied care if they can't pay for it. So if somebody has cancer and they can't afford to pay the hospital for the surgery, and many hospitals require that payment up front if you don't have insurance, then they're denied surgery for their cancer. People who don't have insurance are charged more than people who have insurance because they don't get that group rate. But it's also people with insurance who struggle to be able to pay for care. And along with that study showing the number of deaths because people don't have insurance, there was another study that our organization did this past year showing that 62% of all bankruptcies are due to medical debt, and 80% of those people who went bankrupt from medical debt had health insurance.
So it's not helping even if you have it. I believe that that was the premise of the movie Sicko, that it was dealing mostly with people who had insurance rather than those who did not.
Right. If you look at Donna Smith, who was in Sicko and who now works for the California Nurses Association, and she and I have worked very closely together over this past year, not only had she been working for decades, been insured, you know, for a long period of time, paying her premiums every month, she had a health savings account and a disability plan. And she and her husband still lost everything that they owned after all those years of working because of medical conditions.
Now, I have a friend who got a job roughly 6 months ago. He'll be eligible for the company's health insurance plan in April. He makes $10 an hour, and that's after having gotten a raise. The company's health plan has a $10,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
And he broke his toe recently and was not able to go to a doctor to see to it. He took a couple of days off from work because actually they sent him home. He tried to work and they said, no, that's not safe. And they sent him home. They don't have paid sick leave. So he didn't get treatment. He was out of work and out of money. And even if he had the insurance, the deductible is so high as to not take care of something like that. Is that the way the current system is headed, that we're basically going to have just programs for major medical coverage and we'll still be out dollars for things like broken toes or flu and colds and things like that?
Right. Yeah. If you look at the current legislation, people are forced to buy private insurance, and there's different levels of benefits that people will be able to choose from to buy, but it's based on what you can afford. So a person like that can only afford the lowest benefit plan, which only covers 60% of their health care costs and has high deductible and co-pays. They're still going to face significant financial barriers to getting care when they need it. It does more harm than good, because when people are forced to make an economic decision about whether to go see the doctor or pay for food for their family or pay their rent, they often put off that visit to the doctor. And they do that in many situations until the condition that they have gets to a point where they can no longer do that. They're in so much pain or they're so sick that they finally need to go. And then they're at a point where maybe they could have been treated very easily in the beginning, but now they're much sicker. It's more expensive for them to get care, or they're going to have a worse outcome. Maybe they're going to be disabled or out of work for longer because of waiting. It's a very irrational situation that we place people in this country. And again, we're the only industrialized nation who has that kind of model. And under a national Medicare for All, there would be no co-pays and no deductibles. You just pay into the system through like an income tax. And whatever your need is, the system is there for you to get the care that you need to keep you healthy so that you're working.
It seems that people who have or think they have good insurance through employment do not see the shortcomings of health insurance through employment. What efforts are being made by groups like PNHP and others to get the message across that the system is very broken?
Oh, well, we have been pretty consistently saying that each one of us is just one illness, one accident, one paycheck, you know, away from becoming bankrupt in this country. If you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. And even though we have COBRA coverage, many people can't afford the COBRA that would allow them to keep their employment-based insurance.
To illustrate that point, here are parts of a story I did on COBRA in January of 2009 about a report by an organization called Families USA comparing unemployment compensation benefits with the cost of COBRA.
We were getting so many calls from unemployed people who couldn't afford COBRA during this economic downturn.
Cheryl Fish Parchman, Deputy Director of Health Policy at the health consumer advocacy group Families USA.
This is a time when people need to stay on unemployment benefits for a long time while they're waiting for a job, and they simply can't afford to keep their coverage.
Workers laid off from businesses with at least 20 employees can continue their health insurance coverage for 18 months under the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1985, commonly known as COBRA. The catch is that the laid-off worker must pay 100% of the premium plus a 2% administrative fee, as opposed to the average 16 to 27% of the premium he or she paid while on the job. Mary Bayless of Jupiter, Florida, lost her job March 31, 2008. She draws $270 per week in unemployment benefits, and that's not enough to maintain health insurance for herself and her husband.
We're doing our best to try to make the payments, but it's almost $900 a month. We just got a thing in the mail the first week in January telling us that it's gone up an additional $170 a month, so now it's over $1,000, so we'll no longer be able to afford it.
Families USA recently issued a report called Squeezed, Caught Between Unemployment Benefits and Healthcare Costs. Crushed would be a better term. According to the report, in 9 states, including Florida, the average premiums for family coverage under COBRA equal or exceed total unemployment income. In 32 other states, including California, New York, Texas, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, plus the District of Columbia, premiums for family coverage under COBRA would consume, on average, more than 3/4 of average unemployment income. And COBRA is not even an option for workers whose employer goes out of business. The alternatives are a hodgepodge of state and federal programs that cover only certain groups of people or offer coverage for a much shorter time than does federal COBRA. One alternative is a federal law called HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It has a 30-day window to allow workers to join their spouse's job-based health plan, an obvious non-starter for those who are not married. The law also guarantees some workers who had at least 18 months of coverage the right to purchase a designated plan that does not exclude pre-existing conditions in the individual health insurance market. But there is no federally mandated cap on premiums, and newer workers are not protected. Medicaid, called Medi-Cal in California, the safety net for low-income people, covers very few of the unemployed. In most states, childless adults are not eligible for Medicaid, no matter how low their income, and budget shortfalls are prompting states to cut their Medicaid budgets. Families USA is also calling for, quote, a meaningful subsidy, unquote, to be provided to the recently unemployed so that they can afford COBRA coverage. This is important because in 45 states, insurers can deny individual policies to applicants who were eligible for COBRA but did not participate. Again, Cheryl Fish Parchman.
We always hear from consumers who don't realize that to be protected against pre-existing condition exclusions, they have to have used up their COBRA rights, and they just go to the individual market to buy health insurance. Then they buy policies and they find out when they've had a long-term health condition and they go to get services, that those services simply aren't covered.
Gaps in coverage can be dangerous not only to a worker's health, but to future insurability. Workers who have been without coverage for more than 63 days may have to wait a full year before their new employer-based health plan covers treatment for their pre-existing conditions. Also, in many states, When such workers try to buy coverage in the individual health insurance market, insurers can turn them down or permanently refuse to cover their pre-existing conditions. This can lead to dire economic consequences, a scenario familiar to Mary Bayless.
Pretty much everything else out there is unaffordable. We're going to try to see if we can just get some kind of major medical. My husband's diabetic, so he's considered uninsurable. So once we lose this, we're going to have a hard time getting any kind of insurance for him. But he lost his job. This was in the 80s when there was another recession back then. And because of medical bills, we couldn't afford our home anymore.
Currently, are you facing that?
Not within the next 6 months, but it's a definite possibility if something drastic doesn't happen, you know, within the next year.
Bayless would like to see a credit union type arrangement in which residents of a community who are seeking individual policies could band together for group rates. The Families USA report focuses only on temporary fixes, but the organization would like to see long-term reform. That's also the goal of Physicians for a National Health Program, which advocates for single-payer health care. Dr. Don McCann, a senior health policy fellow for PNHP, says the time is right for that approach.
We say the political realities are such that people are hurting so much with financial hardship and poor health outcomes with our very expensive system that we don't have any other political choice than to go ahead and change to a single-payer national health program.
The report, Squeezed, Caught Between Unemployment Benefits and Health Care Costs, is available at familiesusa.org. Back to Dr. Flowers.
Every single one of us is vulnerable, even those who have very high incomes. I know the story of a cardiac surgeon who developed a serious illness and lost everything that he had, ended up dying and leaving his family with nothing. We've tried to make the people understand that not only are we at personal risk of bankruptcy due to medical debt, but that it's also a public health issue in that if there are people in our community that are not getting care, it makes us more susceptible to getting contagious diseases, but it also puts a strain on families and parents can't work and provide for their children. It's not good for the whole community.
I assume now that you think healthcare is a human right, am I correct?
Yes, not only do I believe that healthcare is a human right, and I think most people in America agree with that, whether they're willing to admit it. If they saw somebody collapse in front of them in the street, they would probably not leave them there. They would probably at least want that person to be taken in for treatment. But the countries that use a human rights-based approach, which is every other industrialized nation, spend less than we do and has better health outcomes. So not only is it morally right, but it makes sense from an economic and a public health standpoint to use a human rights model for healthcare. The human rights model has three principles: universality, that everybody can get care; equity, that everybody's treated equally and pays in to the system; and then accountability, that the system is accountable. And the countries that follow that model spend less and have a better health outcomes than we do.
I wrote a pro-single-payer article for Op-Ed News last year in which I mentioned that I didn't work a conventional job. That's actually not quite true, but I work at a radio station, but it's too part-time to qualify for health care. The rest of my income I make freelance journalism, and together those two sources of income are not enough for me to afford individual insurance. And I got the following comment from a guy who calls himself the old codger. He said, quote, "You choose not to work a conventional job. That is your right, and I fully support your right to do that. When exercising rights, you also have personal responsibilities that you need to meet. You cannot have rights without the attendant responsibilities. I, as a taxpayer and purchaser of health insurance for myself, do not have a responsibility to support you while you exercise your, quote, right to do what you want to do. I had a right to go into business for myself. I did not have a right to ask anyone else to support me and help me pay for my health care." What do you say to people like old codger who say health care is something you have to work for and is not a human right?
We're trying to create a system that each one of us contributes into so that the system is there for us. We're the only industrialized nation that ties health insurance to employment. It's a really kind of a ridiculous notion. It's something that happened as an anomaly back in the time of World War II when wages were frozen. So employers offered insurance benefits in order to attract employees. They couldn't give raises. And that's how the two got tied. But that makes no sense. And it doesn't serve us well, because when people lose their job or if they can't afford the insurance, like many who are offered insurance to their job still can't afford it. So for one thing, that's, so it's just not a rational way to pay for health care. But the other thing is that if you use that argument, then why do people who don't have children still pay taxes that pay for our public schools? Why do people who don't drive a car pay taxes to keep our roads going? Why do I, as a pacifist, pay for the wars that are going on? Not a logical argument.
Old Codger inspired me to write the following commentary. The poet John Donne, in his Meditation 17, wrote, "No man is an island, entire of itself. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never sent to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." Self-sufficiency, a.k.a. self-reliance or rugged individualism, is one of the great fetishes of American culture. To the self-sufficiency fetishists, being able to take care of oneself and pay one's own way is the opposite side of the coin of freedom. Sacrifice self-sufficiency and you have sacrificed freedom, they claim. Not to be able or willing to take care of yourself is to be an infant. Whether your caretaker is a blood relative, a spouse, a paid caretaker, or Uncle Sam. The debate over health insurance reform has brought out the self-sufficiency fetishists in full force. They post comments all over the internet decrying the idea of socialized medicine. They do not believe that health care is a human right, but a personal responsibility. They are against any government role in healthcare because people should take care of themselves. They see taxation to help other people to get healthcare as confiscation of their hard-earned money. Strangely enough, they never see the ever-increasing premiums charged by private health insurance companies for ever skimpier policies as confiscation. There is one problem with this point of view. Self-sufficiency does not exist. Unless you are grinding your own lenses, drilling your own teeth, and making your own medicine, not to mention setting your own bones, stitching your own cuts, and taking out your own appendix, you are not self-sufficient in healthcare. Doctors, nurses, dentists, pharmacists, optometrists, etc. have been helping you all your life. That's not self-sufficiency. Oh, but you claim that you are self-sufficient because you work for a living or you own a business so that you can pay for all of this help. Well, let me not argue here the barbarism of paying to live on the planet on which you were born. I am content to ask you, Mr. and Ms. Self-Reliant, how did you get that job other than through the agency of someone else willing to employ you? Or how does your business thrive unless you have customers or clients willing to buy your goods and services? Is not the company you work for or the business you own dependent on other suppliers of goods and services? That's not self-sufficiency. What about you, trust fund baby? Never had to work a day in your life? Then somebody worked for you so you could have that inheritance. Likewise, those of you ordinary folks lucky enough to marry rich depend on your spouse's or ex's income. That's not self-sufficiency. If, as a worker, you can purchase health insurance, which is a gateway to health care, not health care itself, it is because your employer provides a plan, or you can afford the individual insurance market. Again, your ability to do this depends on others. The employer must provide the plan and provide you with enough working hours to qualify, and enough of a salary to afford your share of the premium, a 100% employer-paid plan being a rarity today, or enough of a salary for you to afford individual insurance. And if you are like most workers, there was little or no negotiation of salary when you were hired. you took the wage and benefit package offered. The amount and frequency of raises, bonuses, or additional benefits are at your employer's discretion. Even if you are represented by a union, you may have seen a wage or benefit freeze or cut in recent years. Unionists are dependent on the skill of their negotiators. Represented or not, working for a living means an awful lot of dependence for someone who claims self-sufficiency. Perhaps there was a time in this nation when there was such a thing as self-sufficiency. I remember going to a quilt exhibit in Indiana in the late 70s and seeing, in amongst the modern quilts, a 19th century quilt made by a woman who grew the plants from which she spun the thread to make the quilt, as well as the plants from which she made the dye for it. Then she made and dyed the quilt herself. That is self-sufficiency. And even then, she might have had a midwife to help her give birth to her children, so health care, such as it was back then, was not always do-it-yourself. Today, when somebody lauds the virtues of self-reliance, I think of the Unabomber, alone in his Montana shack, building his bombs. Yet even he biked into town once in a while for a sack of flour. If you believe the government accounts, the assassin is always a lone gunman. And I have never read a story of an old lady living alone with a lot of cats that made mention of her being on welfare. At least once a year, I read a story of someone who was discovered dead days, weeks, months, and in one case, 2 years after passing, without family, and unmissed by neighbors or tradespeople. That's the gold standard of self-sufficiency. We are not independent. We are interdependent. And though it costs us something to see that our neighbor is taken care of in times of need, we also benefit from our community's members being as strong and healthy as possible, so that they all can contribute their time and effort in providing goods and services to the community according to their inclinations. That's where freedom comes in. Freedom of choice in what we do with our lives. I fail to see freedom in people working a job, or two or three, just because it was what they could get to pay the bills. In this, Karl Marx was correct. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs, should be the guiding principle of economics. That's socialism, you cry in horror. Yes, it is. So what? We are all members of a society. That is something the self-sufficiency fetishists have forgotten. I asked Dr. Flowers to address some of the common arguments against a Medicare for All health plan. For people who argue that the Constitution does not provide for a federal role in health care, I guess because health care wasn't specifically mentioned in the Constitution, what would you say to them?
But in terms of the constitutionality, whether a government is responsible for ensuring that the people can get health care, our Constitution actually does say that we can tax for general welfare, and health is part of that general welfare.
The first paragraph of Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution says, quote, "The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States."
So having a single-payer approach or a Medicare for All approach, which is funded through taxes, is constitutionally acceptable, but it's also the most fiscally conservative way and gives the most freedom and the most choice of any of the ways to pay for health care.
What do you think of President Obama's opinion that health insurance is like auto insurance and you have to buy auto insurance, so you should be forced to buy health insurance?
Well, I don't agree with that for a few reasons. One is that people can choose whether or not they want to have a car, but none of us can choose whether or not we want to have a body. We're born with that. So we're talking about something that's a privilege, which is driving, and something which is just part of who we are as human beings, having bodies that need to get care from time to time. The other is the fact that having health insurance in this country does not guarantee that you can get the health care that you need. It's a very poor concept, a poor way to finance health care. through health insurance, because usually when we buy insurance, like for our house or for our car, we don't want to use it. I don't want to get in a car accident. I don't want my house to burn down. But I have a body that needs, you know, we all need to get regular checkups and little things that come up from time to time. And so if you're paying for health care, the most cost effective and the fairest and the way that's most accountable and has the best health outcomes is to use a universal single pool of health care dollars.
What do you say to the progressives, the people on the left, that say that we should take whatever bill we can get now because people will die otherwise, and they want the lowest body bag count?
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is the same argument that's been used over and over in this country. And this is really one of the main reasons that I fight for a single-payer system and not for what I call patchwork reforms or just take what you can get right now type of reforms, is because we've used that approach for several decades in this country. People have been told at the state and federal level, take this because it's all you're going to get. And it's the only thing that's politically feasible right now. And as a result of accepting that and compromising in that way, we've moved backwards, not forwards. Our health outcomes are worse. The number of people that are dying is higher. Our health care costs are rising faster, out of control. So that approach has failed over and over again. You finally come to a point where you have to say, why would we try that again, knowing that it's going to fail again? We've put off this struggle. We've put off this work, the hard work that it's going to take to overcome the power of the industries that are profiting right now. We've put that off for too long, and the time is now to take that work on and to create a health system that brings us up to level with the other industrialized nations. You know, as a people, we usually pride ourselves in this country on being really good at things. We're always like, America is the best. But when it comes to healthcare, we're settling for 37.
And what do you say to people who don't want healthcare because it's socialism?
First, I say that a national medical health system is civilized medicine. It's what civilized societies do for their people. And that we're not advocating for socialized medicine. What we're talking about is creating a publicly funded, privately delivered health system. So it takes the best of both. It takes public funding, which is accountable and which has the lowest administrative cost, so it's the most efficient or fiscally conservative way to pay for health care, and puts that with private delivery, which means you can choose any doctor, any hospital. That part doesn't change. Doctors still have their practices. Hospitals still exist. So that's what we're talking about. I call it a common sense solution for healthcare.
I happen to be one of those people who doesn't have insurance and only presents to a doctor when absolutely necessary, and to the point where I've had strokes and one heart attack and double angioplasty. And I still will defy any mandate to buy insurance. So will my friend who I described. And I know of other people. There's a Facebook page of people who pledge not to submit to a mandate. What are you hearing about people who want to resist this mandate?
Well, I didn't realize there was a mass movement going in that direction, but I applaud people if they can couple that with work to work for a national publicly financed health system. I think that that could be very powerful, because we need to let our government know that mandating people to purchase private insurance and taking public dollars and putting them into the hands of private corporations, which are there to create profit for themselves by denying payment for needed care, that is not the solution.
Millions Against Health Insurance Mandates is the Facebook page I told Dr. Flowers about. Here is a story I did on it.
We refuse any mandate to buy health insurance from the same companies who've corrupted Congress with money taken from the sick and dying that they've denied health care to. We pledge never to pay a cent to these criminal corporations, which deserve the corporate death penalty. We will not pay fines, but will go to jail until such involuntary servitude is abolished. We will campaign against so-called representatives who vote for a mandate for private insurance.
That was Evan Ravitz of Boulder, Colorado and Vote.org reading the mission statement of Millions Against Mandates, a Facebook page he started. Full disclosure, I have a Facebook page and signed up for Millions Against Mandates. The Senate has stripped a provision from its version of the bill calling for jail time for people who refuse to buy health insurance. But the House version still has it, so there is still some chance that this penalty will survive the reconciliation process between the two bills. Clearly, President Obama is in favor of some penalty for foregoing health insurance if one can afford it, as he told ABC News.
Penalties are appropriate for people who try to free ride the system and force others to pay for their health insurance.
Obama was against the individual mandate when he was candidate Obama and trying to distinguish his approach to health care from that of his Democratic rival and now Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Clinton favors forcing people to buy health insurance as she did in 1994 when, as First Lady, she spearheaded the attempt of her husband's administration to tackle the health care issue. In 1994, the Congressional Budget Office noted that the United States government had never before made purchase of a good or service a requirement of residency in the United States. Now that that prospect again rears its head, it calls to mind the quote attributed to Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini that fascism should more properly be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Evan Ravitz called the health insurance mandate fascism with a friendly face. But he is not surprised that the Congress might pass a fascist law.
I assume that my misrepresentatives will misrepresent me and will represent the corporations who bribe them the best.
People can find out more information at Millions Against Mandates on Facebook. Back to Dr. Flowers.
It's going to take a social movement, a civil rights movement. It's going to take people going outside of their normal comfort zones in order to fight hard enough to get a system that works for all of us.
Dr. Flowers, you were one of the Baucus 8 who were arrested when Senator Baucus refused to allow testimony in single-payer at his hearings. What did that experience tell you about the operation of Congress and about the insurance industry's influence in politics?
We did that action because we had tried the normal avenues. A coalition of organizations came together loosely together for a number of years, but once President Obama was elected, we came together more formally and with a concentrated effort to be part of the debate, as we knew that health care was going to be a top issue. And so we met with leadership in Congress, we met with many of the members and said, just include us in the discussion so we can have an open and honest debate. And when it came down to the first set of hearings, which were in the Senate Finance Committee, they refused to allow us to have one person testify. They had 41 people testifying over 3 days, and most of them represented the industries that are currently profiting off of the situation, and none of them represented our point of view. So we knew then that it was just crystal clear that we were going to be excluded, that they never had any intention of including single-payer advocates in the discussion. So that's why we stood up in that committee to make it publicly known that that exclusion was happening. And, you know, we've continued to push and to work, meeting with members. We did get to testify, but what we saw is that there's a very close relationship between the industries that profit and the legislation that's being written. People that work for the industry will leave their positions there and become staffers to work on the legislation in Congress. Staffers know that when they leave their positions as staffers, they can often go into the industry and work as lobbyists for the industry because they have relationships with members of Congress. So there's this revolving door. And in the Senate Finance Committee in particular, which received a lot of money from the industry for campaign contributions, also the woman who headed up the health care process in that committee, Liz Fowler, left a very lucrative position as vice president of public policy at WellPoint, one of the largest insurance companies in the country, to work in that committee to oversee this legislative process. So, and it's no surprise if you look at the legislation that came out of Senate Finance Committee, it was written with the health insurance industry in mind to benefit them.
Now, up to a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, I would have said that the best health care reform, the best reform of any kind in the United States would be campaign finance reform. Mm-hmm. But the Supreme Court decision recently that says corporations are people with free speech rights and can spend the money any way they choose is going to ruin that chance? Do you think things are going to get worse now because of that decision?
I do think that things can be worse now because of that. We've already seen that there's so much corporate control over our media that the corporate message is the one that gets out through mainstream media. And that's another indication that what we need is a real people's social justice movement. Healthcare is one issue in that social justice movement. But we know that we have a lot of work to do in this country to get financial reform, to get energy reform so that we can address climate change and employment. And there's so many areas that we need to work on. And now more than ever, people have got to come together in these various social justice movements and work together to overcome that industrial power.
Some people have called this bill a bailout for the health insurance industry. Do you look at this as a bailout?
I do look at it as a bailout. I mean, basically back in, you know, October of 2008, when stocks dropped so precipitously, the major insurers, because they are really financial institutions, they did lose quite a bit of money during that time. What's interesting, though, is that even with the economic downturn, and we know that last year the private insurance companies lost 2.7 million enrollees, they continued to make record profits. They've recovered quite nicely. But the reason that we call this a bailout, and maybe if you don't want to say bailout, we could say handout, but it is forcing people to purchase private insurance, and then the other part is taking our public dollars, our taxpayer dollars, and subsidizing the purchase of private insurance. So we're giving those dollars directly to the private insurance companies. And we were fighting to say, if you're going to take public dollars and use them for health care, use them to support our public programs, because the public programs are the ones that have the best outcomes and they're the most efficient use of our health care dollars.
Well, what about the talk that any kind of so-called health reform is going to come out of the pockets of the current Medicare recipients?
We're seeing a continuing trend towards privatizing Medicare and also this work to address fraud in Medicare. They play that up as if that's the real problem. The real problem is there's quite a bit of fraud in the private industry, but they don't mind paying millions of dollars in fines because in the big scheme of things, it's not much of a financial loss for them. But we are seeing further desires towards privatization of Medicare, which has been more expensive. Like if you look at the Medicare Advantage program, which is private insurance sold under the name of Medicare, Medicare Advantage takes care of the healthier population of Medicare recipients, and they cost up to 19% more to care for those healthier patients. So that sucks money away from the traditional Medicare. And when you reduce the amount of money that you have to deliver care to a certain number of people, what happens is you either kick people out, which they don't do under Medicare, or you reduce the benefits. So there's concern there, and that's why we support an expansion of Medicare, because if we took all of our health dollars and put them into a single fund under Medicare, you have the 80% of the population that's healthy paying in and more than enough money to pay for the 20% of the population that needs care.
Ruth Ann Spinner has been on Medicare for over 20 years. Because of an accident in which she sustained a severe spinal cord injury that rendered her paraplegic. As she told me in October 2009, she's happy with Medicare, supports Medicare for all, and is concerned about possible changes to Medicare as part of a so-called health reform. You think favorably of Medicare, don't you?
Yes. Unqualitatively. I think as a model, it is wonderful. After all I'm hearing about what people are going through with health care, and after I saw the film Sicko, and after all that I'm hearing about health care debate, Medicare for all is a model of the best answer. I do have problems with it, but nothing compared to what most people run into with healthcare insurance. I can see any doctor I want to see. There's no gatekeeper. I'm not in an HMO or a plan. And everything is covered, and I have very few problems with it. What's covered are doctor's appointments, tests. Whenever I have a question of being admitted to a hospital and they want to know your insurance, it's never a question if I have Medicare. There's never a problem. Same with doctor's office and visits. Unfortunately, in the United States today, because of the model of insurance, they way over-treat and over-test, et cetera, and so forth. But since I'm a patient in that system and what's advised is MRIs or CAT scans or any of those fancy-dancy, perhaps overkill diagnostic x-rays or treatments, I have absolutely no problems getting it paid for. They are never denied.
Would you advocate H.R. 676, the Medicare for All bill, as opposed to anything that is now likely to pass?
With unqualified endorsement, I would be for 676. Medicare for All. Now that public option has been put off the table for all intents and purposes, even when it was on the table, it wasn't universal health care.
And do you think that any of these so-called health care reforms are a threat to Medicare?
I'm worried that they're going to reduce payments to doctors, even though that continually gets defeated, and that they're going to reduce payments or services in order to pay for all of this. I mean, it has to come from somewhere.
They claim that it would be savings by finding out all levels of fraud. Once in a while, you hear about a Medicare fraud case, but
it's hard for me to imagine what fraud there would be in Medicare. I could put on my thinking cap.
I think that perhaps doctors would be billing for services that they didn't provide.
Yeah, good. Okay, good point. I was thinking, yes, that's a very good point.
But doctors can do that with private insurance as well. Now they're talking about a health care mandate that would require everyone to buy health insurance. What do you think of that?
I think that's horrible.
Do you see Obama's alleged parallel between his individual health care mandate and the requirement that we have auto insurance for drivers?
No, because as they always tell you when you read on the California license thing, when you go to get your license renewed, that it is a privilege, not a right. Health care is not a privilege unless you want to tell someone it's a privilege to be alive. I mean, people are thankful to be alive, but the option is to not be alive. I think the mandating auto insurance is safety to others. If you've got the privilege to drive the car, you have to be insured in case you get in a car accident and injure somebody else. There's no parallel between that and health, because if I get a heart attack or if I get in a second accident like this, that's not covering somebody else's costs.
I see it this way. This bill currently should be killed. I call it the Greater Health Insurance Industry Profits Act of 2010. And we should start over again with single payer being right up on the table. I get letters on the internet all the time. Oh, tell people to support the public option. Make them vote on the public option. The public option is not single payer. Perhaps you can explain the differences between the two first, and then tell me if you think we can start over again.
The public option is not single payer. We did not see it as a backdoor to single payer, which some were hoping, primarily because we've seen these types of reforms occur at the state level. And we know that whenever you have publicly funded insurance and privately funded insurance going hand in hand, the private insurance tracks the healthier population and the sicker population ends up in the public insurance, which then suffers under the burden of paying for the health care costs of that population. So we've seen it fail over and over again in this country, and we know that it's not a workable model. So we didn't support the public option. It just doesn't address the fundamental problems that we have in this country of this fragmented financing. It really just added one more choice, you know, a publicly funded choice. And Steffi Wohlhandler, one of the founders of our organization, Physicians for National Health Program, says it's like sending the Pee Wee football team in against the NFL. They're not going to win. We agree that passing this legislation is going to further empower the very industries which are the problem. It's not going to be universal. It's not going to be sustainable. It's going to fail. It's designed to fail.
The current legislation, if it's designed to fail as a healthcare system, what do you think it's designed to succeed as?
It's going to succeed at further empowering the insurance industry, which will then become a part of our health financing that will be very hard to get rid of. It's not going to be universal. People are going to be left out. People are still going to be only be able to afford the health care that, you know, they have the money for. And over time, you know, our public health systems, I think, are really going to suffer. Our states are going to suffer trying to pay for the care for their people.
What do you think of the idea of letting the states do their own single-payer systems?
I think that it's an important approach. I mean, it's ideally, we could get this done at the national level because that's the fastest way to save lives, and it's the least complicated. When you deal with states, you're dealing with borders and people who live in one state but work in another, and vice versa, or people crossing state lines when they're traveling or moving or whatever. But I think it's important to try that route hand in hand with working at the national level, because some states are close to passing single-payer legislation. California's passed it twice already and is poised to pass it a third time this year. Pennsylvania feels very confident that they will pass their bill this year as well, and their governor has agreed to sign that bill. And we have, I think, 19 states in total that are actively working on single-payer legislation. The current bill under consideration prohibits states from enacting their own health systems until 2017, and that's another problem.
Another problem, I would think, and I'm here in California, is that a lot of the states, especially California, are broke right now, and perhaps that will be the big argument against the legislation, even if it passes again. The governor, Schwarzenegger, will probably veto it a third time. How can the states take on this responsibility in this economic climate?
Well, if he vetoes the legislation because he thinks it's too expensive, then he's not looking at the data, because it's been demonstrated over and over again, including in California, through economic studies, that creating a single-payer health system will actually save the state money. I can't remember now off the top of my head what the numbers were in California, but for instance, here in the state of Maryland, a study done 10 years ago showed that we would save $348 million a year if we introduced a single-payer health system. And so that's money that our state could really use. So you can't make an economic argument against it. Single-payer has been shown over and over consistently to save money. We don't really need to even start from scratch, though. We have a system that's been working very well in this country for 44 years, and it's a Medicare system. So it's as simple as taking that and improving it to make it more comprehensive and expanding it to everybody. We've put off this struggle for too long, and it is going to take many of us getting active and getting involved to create change. So I encourage your listeners to do that. We have to make it the only politically feasible solution.
You have been listening to a program on single-payer health care. The featured speaker was Baltimore pediatrician Dr. Margaret Flowers, a spokesperson for Physicians for a National Health Program. Their website is pnhp.org. You also heard the voices of Mary Bayless, an unemployed person needing health insurance, Cheryl Fish Parchman of Families USA, Dr. Don McCann, Senior Health Policy Analyst for PNHP, Evan Ravitz of Millions Against Health Insurance Mandates and Voter.org, Ruth Ann Spinner, a Medicare patient, and President Barack Obama. 2 days after Barack Obama appeared in his district in Cleveland, Ohio, Dennis Kucinich announced that he was going to vote for the Greater Health Insurance Industry Profits Act of 2010. Oh, he didn't put it that way. Those are my words. His words, taken from his March 17th statement, are these. Quote, "I still have doubts about the bill. I don't think that it is a first step toward anything I have supported in the past. This is not the bill I wanted to support, even as I continue efforts until the last minute to modify the bill. However, after careful discussions with the President Obama, Speaker Pelosi, Elizabeth, my wife, and close friends, I have decided to cast a vote in favor of the legislation. If my vote is to be counted, let it now count for passage of the bill, hopefully in the direction of comprehensive health care reform, unquote. With those words, Dennis Kucinich forfeited his position as a leader in the fight for single-payer health care and destroyed his credibility as an elected official of principle. He told the Democratic leadership that progressivism in Congress is meaningless talk. Just let the progressives make some grandstanding speeches and offer some amendments that will die in committee or can be stripped out of a bill on the House floor, and in the end, the leadership will get what it wants, or rather, what the corporations want. He ended his statement by saying, quote, I have taken a detour through supporting this bill, but I know the destination I will continue to lead for as long as it takes, whatever it takes, to an America where health care will be firmly established as a civil right. I do not believe him because he is not walking his talk now, but rather helping to entrench the health insurance industry even further into our health care, meaning it will be even harder to remove them later. Even if this bill was going to pass without his vote, he should have done what Ernest Greening and Wayne Morse did when it came time to vote for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and what Russ Feingold did when it came time to vote on the Patriot Act. They voted no. If health care is indeed a human right, we cannot have this corrupt bill in the name of compromise and bipartisanship or whatever other political claptrap is being bandied about today. You can compromise on whether to go for pizza or ribs, or whether to see a chick flick or an action film. You do not compromise on human rights. I wonder if we would have had the Civil Rights Act of 1964 or the Voting Rights Act of 1965 if the opponents of those acts had to confront the wusses who claim to be progressives today. Medicare was the compromise in its day because it only covered those over 65 and the disabled. Those who say now, if we don't pass something, people will die, should ask themselves how many people have died prematurely in the 44 years since Medicare passed because we have not extended it to everyone. Why Kucinich did this flip-flop only he knows. All I know is that in the past year, it has become crystal clear that the White House, the Congress, and the Supreme Court have been bought and paid for by the corporations. Wall Street, the insurers, Big Pharma, the Pentagon, the arms merchants, and the ever-growing national security apparatus just take our lives, our money, and our freedoms, aided and abetted by their corporate media lackeys and an alternative press too scared to tell the truth or too small to be heard by many. We the people must make the last stand for peace, for health, for democracy, for all the things that make life civilized and make the pursuit of happiness more than just a lovely phrase. There are groups throughout the country dedicated to one or more of the various issues we must deal with to destroy corporate hegemony. The one I wish to draw your attention to at this moment is the New American Independence Movement, INDEPENDENTS. Whose members pledge to never vote for a Democrat or a Republican again. Look for the New American Independence Movement on Facebook. It's the least you can do. You have been listening to Broadcaster at Large, challenging the assumptions we live by. Theme music composed and performed by Jeff Watson. Visit our website, broadcasteratlarge.blogspot.com. Join our Facebook fan page, Broadcaster at Large, and follow us on Twitter at BCASTER at Large. That's BCASTERATLARGE. To give feedback, send an email to kelliasworld@yahoo.com. That's KELLIAS world@yahoo.com. I'm Kellia Ramirez. Thanks for listening.